my thinking is always resilience. How do I make Proton resilient? And the conclusion I came to after thinking about it for a long time is actually the best way to be resilient is to enable the entire Proton community of 100 million people to very, very easily adopt Bitcoin, which is a form of money that's outside of centralized control.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have an awesome chat today. We have Andy Yin, the founder and CEO of Proton.me, used to be Proton Mail, on the show. And they have recently created or built a non-custodial Bitcoin wallet built into Proton as a service in Proton. And it's still in beta. It's not public yet. But I immediately was like, I was rethinking everything that I thought I knew about Proton. I've been using Proton Mail for a long time. But I did not know their history with Bitcoin or how much they were Bitcoiners and to what degree. And I immediately reached out and I was like, dude, I really want to get somebody on the show. I want to talk about this. This seems really interesting. And the article that I read for the announcement of it was very like, this is Bitcoin only. We are non-custodial all the way. This is the only way that this is even feasible or that aligns with their principles to do this. And it just sounded like it was written by a Bitcoiner. And that surprised me. And what's really cool is throughout this conversation, I kind of found out that their origin story or Proton Mail was actually very much tied to their origin story with Bitcoin. Like the birth of Proton Mail and the birth of their understanding and exposure to Bitcoin are the same story. And I thought that was fascinating. And we just had a really, really awesome discussion. And it got me that much more excited about Proton. I've not really dove into it. I just thought it was a good service. And no, just kind of having that story, I just feel like just makes it that much better. So I hope you guys enjoy this as well. I hope to be able to test this out soon and kind of give you, you know, my assessment and how easy it is to use the wallet. And it should be public soon, so you'll probably get to try it out as well. But really quick, I just want to thank our sponsor, CoinKite, and the Cold Card hardware wallet for keeping my Bitcoin safe. I love my Cold Card. I love using it with Nunchuck Wallet in particular. It's just a fantastic device. And if you don't have a hardware wallet and you aren't withdrawing, dear God, if you have Bitcoin on an exchange, please withdraw your coins. Get yourself a Cold Card. You can get one with a discount code that is Bitcoin Audible, all one word, easy to remember. Links and details will be right in the show notes. And you'll also support the show. And a shout out to everybody on Fountain who gives me a boost. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it. And all the supporters and the Audionauts, you guys are what make this possible. So thank you. But with that, let's get into today's chat with Andy Yin from Proton Mail. Andy, welcome to the show. You are the CEO and you are the founder. Is that as well?
Yeah, that's correct.
CEO and founder of Proton Mail, which honestly should probably just rebrand to like Proton all the things. You guys have recently been, I've been a long time user of Proton Mail. So I have always been a fan. I bugged my family members to get onto Proton Mail as well so that we can, you know, communicate back and forth. My brother's on it, my sister-in-law, my wife and everything. And I've been really a huge fan of it for a long time. And I just recently found out that you were doing a non-custodial Bitcoin wallet, which I didn't even realize that you guys were kind of into Bitcoin or your philosophy and thinking about it. And I was immediately impressed. And I was like, this is much different than I had assumed. And I just want to say thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me about this. And also just kudos. You guys have a really awesome stack. And I am increasingly impressed by it. And I really appreciate you coming on to talk to me about it.
Yeah, of course. It's a pleasure to be here. I think, you know, we are longtime fans of the Bitcoin space, and it's always great to talk to someone that understands it. And yeah, happy to give our perspective, you know, kind of explain why we're in it. A lot of people were, I think people were surprised, right? They didn't really see it coming. So yeah, happy to come on here and, you know, let's say lift up the covers behind everything that we're doing and give a bit more context.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, in that, I would love to just kind of get the context, because it did kind of seem to come out of nowhere. I didn't know that you guys were like, I think I've paid for Proton Mail in Bitcoin at some point, and yeah, a couple people talked about that. So I knew it just from that angle. But, you know, there's a lot of companies that be like, yeah, I accept Bitcoin too. And they, you know, have BitPay and they turn it to dollars. And it doesn't mean they're Bitcoiners, right? So give me the background. Where did this idea start? When did y'all start being interested from a company perspective into Bitcoin? Yeah. And how did we get here?
Yeah, I think the surprising thing is it's actually right at the very beginning. So the history of Proton was, it was created in 2014. At that time, I was a physicist working at CERN, right? And you know, okay, as a physicist, you don't get paid a lot of money. And we had you know, launched Proton Mail out to the world. Yeah, and today is Proton, because it's a whole suite of products. Now, back then, it was just Proton Mail back in those days, right? And we had just come out of, you know, of, we were kind of in stealth at the beginning. And then we had launched it into a public beta. And we got something like 10,000 users signing up on the first day. So it was really a big hit, you know, right out of the gate. Yeah.
That's wild. I had no idea.
Yeah, so that was how Proton Mail started. And it was all running on, you know, a pretty cheap server that I had purchased that was, you know, sitting on a shelf somewhere, right? And this is back when I was working as a physicist at CERN. Mm-hmm. And that server was filling up really quickly. So we're like, okay, we have a lot of users coming in, you know, 10,000 per day. And actually, we put a wait list on it at the very beginning, which is kind of funny, because there's a wait list now on Proton Wallet, which I can explain later as well, right? But users came in to start using Proton Mail. And we had simply no money to scale the service.
Yeah.
And in those days, there weren't a lot of options, right? You could try to get VC financing, but you know, our pitch was something along the lines of, we're going to do what Google is doing and compete against the world's, you know, largest and wealthiest tech company and charge people what Google gives away for free. And that's our business model. And VC's like, yeah, you know, not touching that, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it worked in the end. But back in those days, you know, like, you know, you want to compete with Google, you know, get out of here, right? You're kind of insane. So the result of that was, the only other possibility that we had was crowdfunding. We actually went to Indiegogo. So Proton's birth, to some extent, was a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo, where members of the community were just donating to, you know, support, you know, kind of what we were doing. Now, today in 2024, encryption seems pretty normalized. But back in 2014, it was, you know, kind of an odd thing, right? That was only a decade after maybe all the cyberpunk stuff and all the other issues around, you know, crypto that was, you know, big thing in the 90s, right? So we weren't so far from that. And what happened about a few weeks into the crowdfunding was, one day we woke up and couldn't access any of the funds. And what had happened was, PayPal had decided to freeze our crowdfunding, because according to PayPal at that time, they thought actually encrypting email was illegal. They thought it was something that required a government license permission to do. So their assumption was, oh, this looks like a scam. This looks illegal. Maybe, you know, it's not allowed under US law. We better block this and block their funds. And at that point, we were kind of screwed, right? We had taken all of our money, you know, through PayPal for a crowdfunding campaign to pay for servers, to keep the service alive. And there was, you know, and then it was all gone, basically.
You have no backup. You can't, and appeal process is totally at their disposal. And, you know, whenever they want to worry whether or not you have any money at all, just...
Yes, they don't care, right?
God, and now, you know, it pisses me off so much.
Yes. Now, in this situation, after a bit of time, PayPal did release the funds, but at that time, we were kind of stuck.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that seems like the nail in the coffin at that point. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then someone from the community says, you know what, guys, you should accept Bitcoin, right? You know, Bitcoin can't be blocked. Use Bitcoin. And that was really our first experience and introduction to Bitcoin. It was, we had just had the world ended for us. All of our money was locked up, you know, in a centralized financial institution. Mm-hmm. And then someone said, Bitcoin. So we created a Bitcoin address, put it up there for donations. And actually, quite a bit of money, you know, came in from the community. And then that was when we realized the power of Bitcoin. So, you know, for us getting into the Bitcoin space and building a wallet 10 years later, this is kind of the Proton story going full circle, right? It's going back to the very, very beginning. Because we realized 10 years ago then the power of, you know, Bitcoin and what it can do and the importance of it. And today, we're a much, let's say, a bigger organization, right? You know, Proton today has around 500 employees. There's over 100 million accounts. So it's a different scale compared to the early days.
Wow, that's awesome. Congratulations. That is sick. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But in the back of our minds, we always have the same concern. And the same concern is, how can we best serve this community going forward? And today, any business, whether it's Proton or any other business, even businesses much bigger than us, we're actually very vulnerable. We're quite vulnerable because today we still have a single point of failure. And that single point of failure is a financial system, right? It's Visa, it's MasterCard, it's big banks. It's this system that if it fails, can still take us down. So my thinking is always resilience. How do I make Proton resilient? And the conclusion I came to after thinking about it for a long time is actually the best way to be resilient is to enable the entire Proton community of 100 million people to very, very easily adopt Bitcoin, which is a form of money that's outside of centralized control. So that is really, I would say, the chain of logic that, you know, drove us to produce Proton Wallet. And it really came from this near-death experience that we suffered very early on that forever changed the mindset and the viewpoint of the business as a whole.
That's so cool. I had no idea that that was like so tied to the origin story of Proton Mail. That's wild. Tell me more about this integration. Actually, you know what, just for the audience who isn't super familiar with Proton Mail, give me the rundown for Proton Mail, just for the people who don't know.
Well, you know, I've kind of changed the elevator pitch over the years, right? You know, back in my scientist days, it was, you know, it's PGP, but, you know, one click less, right? nowadays, what I tell people is Proton Mail is like Gmail, just without the creepy business model. and that's it. Right. It's end-to-end encrypted. You have control over your data. We cannot access your emails. You know, we cannot mine your data. We cannot steal your data. We cannot resell your information. It is email, but it's with privacy, mathematically guaranteed through encryption. You know, I think today when you go online, you sort of have a choice. You know, you can, well, option A, right? You get a service for free from Google. And in exchange, you give Google your most valuable, intimate, and sensitive information. And you hope they don't abuse it, which we know they do, right? And then there's option B, which is what Proton Mail is trying to do, which is you can pay a coffee a month, around $4 per month, to ensure that all your data online forever belongs to you in a mathematically guaranteed way. And actually paying is actually optional, right? Because there's a free version as well, so you don't have to pay, but you know, you could pay if you wanted to. And I think what has happened in the past 10 years is when confronted with these two options, a lot of people are saying, actually, I'd rather pay, you know, $4 a month to ensure that my data is forever secure and belongs to me. And that is really what we're about, you know, giving people that choice.
That's awesome. So I have a bunch of my stuff spread out. And this is what I mentioned just before we started recording is that I had been interested in the VPN and the drive because I'd just kind of been seeing it in my Proton Mail because I've been a Proton Pro or whatever it is for a long time, a couple of years now at least. But it really wasn't until the wallet and then I read the article releasing talking about the wallet or whatever. And I just had a lot more context about how you guys thought about stuff. And I was like, well, crap, like it made me rethink all of your other products. And he's like, maybe I could just use these instead and not have four different subscriptions for something that's, you know, could be a package basically. Tell me about the other products that you have and that you've expanded from just email.
Yeah, I think it's not just a privacy, you know, focused email, but an ecosystem. And this is because Google has a pretty, it's a pretty creepy, but also a pretty clever business model, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they build a whole ecosystem of products, and that is really what locks you in. It makes it impossible to leave their ecosystem. And I think for us to give people a viable option to, you know, not be trapped on Google, we need to build also an ecosystem. So for the mail product, of course, you need to also have calendar, because email without calendaring doesn't really work, right? And then once you build the calendar, people started asking for, we also need to have file storage. So there's a Proton Drive product as well. And then we also thought to ourselves, this encryption doesn't really work if people forget their passwords. And this is happening quite a bit. So let's build a password manager to try to avoid that issue as well, right? Because securing your passwords is also extremely important. We also knew in the early days that Proton wasn't going to be popular in some countries. It was going to get blocked in Russia, Iran, these other countries where democracy is not really a thing, right?
Yeah.
So the VPN was added to the offering as well in order to ensure that no matter where you went in the world, you could access Proton. And then the wallet is sort of the last addition. So this is kind of the entire ecosystem. And of course, we hope to add more things in the future, but it's an incremental process. You know, Google wasn't built in a day. Google was built in 20 years. Yeah, I think Proton will probably need, that much time, if not longer, to build out the whole ecosystem as well.
Yeah. Give me your thinking in the breakdown, some of what you covered in the article for the wallet, and then where you are going long-term with this too. Like what's the trajectory? Because this is obviously kind of the door opening on the wallet here.
Yeah.
Where do you intend to take that?
Mm-hmm. There's really a couple of paths that are possible. And which path you look at depends on both sort of short-term and long-term. And I think I'll start with kind of, the long-term. And then we come down to the short-term, right? In the long run, for Proton to compete with Google and Apple and these other, closed big tech ecosystems, payments is inevitable. There is Google Play, there's Apple Pay, these things exist. Because payments is an integral, part of your overall online existence. Paying with your phone, paying with your, apps, you sort of need this. And from that perspective, I would say, Proton Wallet today, starting with Bitcoin, will probably eventually have to also support fiat currencies after we have secured the licenses that we need, right? So that is probably something that user and community demand is going to eventually dictate as being necessary in the very long run. Now, in the short term, our objective, of course, is not so broad. What we want to do is simply build the most secure and easiest to use non-custodial Bitcoin wallet, focusing just on Bitcoin. And of course, security is part of Proton's DNA. And we've done a lot to make it extremely secure. And there's a lot of things that we do a bit different, right? But what I'm really trying to do is actually build a Bitcoin wallet that, my mother, maybe even my grandmother could actually use. And that's a user experience problem that's really difficult to solve, but I think it's fundamental to having Bitcoin adoption spread, because the user experience problem still is, in my opinion today, the biggest friction to adoption.
Yeah, without a doubt. The user, and it's funny because I've been trying to, I'm not sure if you ever used Phoenix Wallet. It was a very popular Lightning wallet. They've recently left the United States. Well, they've left the App Store. I can still use it, but now I can't recommend it. And I basically try to build my structure of the wallets I recommend and the tools that I use around stuff that I could easily and quickly onboard somebody that I'm discussing with, like a waiter or my contractor or whatever, because I'm onboarding them right now. And that user experience is so unbelievably critical in getting them to over the hump. Because there are so many things that I think, like, as a Bitcoiner, and after you understand these tools, you just kind of dismiss this step. It's like, people will get it. And it's like, no, they won't. Those people are busy. Mm-hmm. Like, they have lives. They got bills to pay. They don't want a homework assignment, and they're not going to do a homework assignment. So,
and that's a bias, right? That's a bias because we're early adopters. Early adopters are, technical. And within the, product world, there's a concept known as, crossing the chasm. And that's really how do you cross over from early adopters to what we call the early majority and eventually the late majority, right? And it's a chasm because, in fact, most companies don't succeed in making this crossing, and this is where they die, right?
Yeah.
You can almost draw an analogy between that to the entire Bitcoin ecosystem. You know, we are right now at the stage where we must cross the chasm. And that's really difficult because there's been so much bad things that happened, right? You know, you have all this crypto stuff, which is 90%, you know, scams. You have stories of, you know, FTX losing billions and people getting wiped out, right? People have bought some random NFTs or some random, you know, quote unquote shit coins somewhere and, you know, got wiped out, you know, millions of people lost billions, right? As they say. And unless we clean up this problem and, you know, give security, reliability, and dependability, you know, Bitcoin and crypto more broadly is never going to go mainstream. And this is why I think, you know, people say, oh, there's a privacy problem we're solving. There's a sovereignty problem that we're solving. There's a, you know, a user experience problem that we're solving, all these different things, right? But I think the main thing that we really need to fix is user experience. Because once you address that, it's a lot easier to tackle the other pieces. But it has to be in that order, you know, in my opinion, let's say.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I think user experience is everything. Even with the trade-off, when we're talking about like the people who are like crazy cypherpunks and stuff, like they'll always find the most sovereign and like best way to do it for the kind of for what they're going for. They're always going to be able to take that next step or do the little annoying thing to get that extra privacy or whatnot. And I think for everyone else, like it needs to be about user experience in the most like have like one or two principles, like one or two things that you do not compromise on, and then build that user experience around providing those things. So on that note, because I don't really know anything on the technical side, like how have you guys built a non-custodial wallet? How does the, you know, the node work? Are you guys running a node that they're referencing the blockchain from, like that sort of thing? Like how's the architecture? Why is this non-custodial? How have you managed to make this non-custodial is maybe my question.
Yeah. Actually, a non-custodial wallet is in many ways a lot harder to do than a custodial one, right? At least from a technical standpoint. You know, legal is a different thing. Let's put that aside for now. Maybe come back to the legal question later, right? But technically, non-custodial is difficult. But I think at Proton, we didn't really have a choice, because if you look at Proton, all of our products, whether it's the email product or the file storage product or the password manager, we believe in something called end-to-end encryption. And that means, you know, your keys belong to you. And in Bitcoin, I think that's really important because there's a saying that, you know, I'm sure you know, not your keys, not your coins, right? So non-custodial was key for us. And another reason why I think non-custodial is very important is it's also a question of security as well. Right? A custodial exchange or centralized exchange is going to put a giant target on their back because every hacker in the world knows you can go there and you can get some coins. You know, at Proton, well, we don't have your keys, we don't have your coins. Yeah. So there's no use coming to try to hack this because in fact, we don't have, you know, the coins. There's no vault somewhere that's storing a bunch of coins on some device, right? Yeah. And that was also important for us as well for the overall security posture of the business. So, you know, having said that, what does it take to build a non-custodial wallet? Well, we also want to do it in a very private way. And that means that we don't want, you know, our queries to the blockchain to become known to a third party, right? And if you outsource your nodes, basically they can see what you're querying and what you're creating and things like that. So the wallet looks simple. In fact, it looks deceptively simple because it was done intentionally to make it easy to use, right? But behind that, there's actually an entire Bitcoin blockchain infrastructure, including, you know, full nodes that we run and we maintain. And you have to make that resilient as well so that it can fail over if there's issues. So our stack is actually built from the ground up, you know, all entirely done in-house, hosted in our own data centers, all the way from, you know, from the nodes to the APIs to actually the applications themselves. And that was a lot of work. It was not, let's say, the easy path. But I think it's the way you have to do it. If you want to be secure, if you want to be private, it's really the only way to do it. So our goal really was to, let's say, build a wallet that a hardcore Bitcoiner would say, this checks all the boxes that, you know, I care about. But at the same time, also be so accessible that same person could recommend it to a newcomer. Mm-hmm.
The most important thing that you can do in order to secure your Bitcoin is to use a secure, trusted, long-running hardware wallet in the Bitcoin space and do one that is Bitcoin only, like the Cold Card.
Not only do they have the Cold Card Mark IV, which is the cypherpunk calculator, but they also now have the Cold Card Q, which has the large screen, has a full QWERTY keyboard, has a flashlight, and a QR code scanner. It is the cypherpunk BlackBerry of the Cold Card series. And if you are looking to keep your Bitcoin safe and you want all of those advanced features, you want to do some custom setup with multi-sig, you want security features for those edge case scenarios where you need a brick me pin or a dummy pin that opens up to a fake wallet, the Cold Card has it all. And if you don't want to complicate your setup or you don't need any of those advanced features, you can use it simply as a secure default Bitcoin signing device. Keep your seed, keep your keys off of your desktop computer, off of your phone, and securely and easily use your Bitcoin. If you do not have a Cold Card or you haven't even checked it out yet, go to coinkite.com. The link will be right in the show notes. And don't forget that when you are at your checkout, the code BITCOINAUDIBLE, all one word, will get you a discount. That will also be right in the show notes in case you forget about it. Keep your keys safe and get yourself a Cold Card.
So you were saying, how did you technically solve the querying problem from the blockchain with the individual user?
Well, everything goes through our API, which queries our own node, right? Mm-hmm. And we have our own servers that basically, you know, cache all the information. Mm-hmm. So if we were using, like, say, you know, a third-party provider, all those calls would go there. But this call mm-hmm. instead goes into our own infrastructure. So does so the lookups that you do on the blockchain, you know, through your wallet, this is never exposed to a third party.
Gotcha. So I'm curious too, and in fact, just because this comes up, I feel like, because there's, you know, articles about it, and I'd want to give you just the opportunity to address it. And I know you've addressed it in other places, but just for the sake of the audience, is somebody was sharing around an article that, oh, Proton Mail complied with the Swiss government on some exposing some user or something like that. And if you look in the details, it seems pretty obvious, but can you respond to that? First, what do you have to comply with the, you know, the tools and how you've built it? And what can you and can't you give the government when they basically come knocking on your door?
Yeah. Well, the general principle for government requests is, number one, unless your company is operated on, you know, a boat offshore, you know, you have to comply with some government somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And when it comes to your money, you probably don't want to depend on the, you know, company on the boat offshore, right? Because that has many, let's say, risk. Yeah, yeah. You want someone that's stable, that, you know, you want to know where they're based so you can knock on the door and have someone to sue if they lose your money, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, we don't play the offshore game. There's Binance that's trying to be, oh, you know, you don't know where we are. Our headquarters are hidden, wherever. Yeah, we don't want to play that game because we know that game doesn't end well and we're in the long run, right? So given that you don't want to be on a boat offshore, what is your next best option? Your next best option is to look at all the legal jurisdictions in the world and find the one that's best for privacy. And that's the reason why Proton is in Switzerland. That's the reason why Proton Wallet is also in Switzerland, because this, in fact, is the, let's say, the onshore jurisdiction that is overall, best for privacy. Now, Switzerland isn't, you know, like a Pirate of the Caribbean type of place either, right? There are laws, there are regulations, there are things that they comply with. If we are requested to log an IP address, we of course can do that because that's how TCP/IP work. That's how the internet is set up. And then be asked to turn that over. Now, of course, if you have an issue with that, there's VPN, there's Tor, there's different things that you can do to, you know, obfuscate your identity. And there's an interesting, I would say, a loophole in Swiss law, and maybe not a loophole, but maybe let's say a feature and not a bug, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that under Swiss law, VPN providers cannot, in fact, be compelled to log.
Oh, that's cool.
Because the law doesn't.
I did not realize that.
Right? You know, email providers can, but VPNs cannot. So in fact, you could just use Proton VPN and solve that problem, right? so it's not even that hard to fix. But this is funny. I think this is the difference between privacy and being anonymous, right? Mm-hmm. Privacy is something you can expect a third-party company to provide for you. Google doesn't do it, but I think we can all have a reasonable expectation of privacy from third-party companies. But being anonymous, that's not something a third party can provide for you, right? That's something that you need to do yourself, because it's a series of proactive actions that you take, whether it's using a VPN, whether it's using cache instead of card. You know, you have to do that yourself, because no one can give that to you. And I think people often confuse, you know, the two concepts. And you know, even Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is, it's not anonymous, it's pseudo-anonymous. And that's an important distinction that people need to have. So it's not controlled by any third party, but you're not by any means completely hidden. And this is, I think, the sort of same distinction, right? So, you know, we can provide privacy, but anonymity, you know, that's up to you. And I think in Bitcoin, it's very similar. So when it comes to the wallet concretely, we don't store balances. You know, we don't, log the addresses that you're sending to it, information like that. So that's not something that people can come to us and say, hey, Proton, here's a court order from Swiss government. Give us information. We don't have it, right? But on the other hand, a law enforcement authority may go and explore the Bitcoin blockchain and figure certain things out, right? And that's something that, you know, you need to be aware of when you use Bitcoin, that it's not completely anonymous, it's pseudo-anonymous, and there's a difference. So we do what we can to minimize data that we have. You know, the fact that we don't have custody of your funds, the fact that we don't have your keys already goes a long way. It means that, you know, financial seizure of your assets can't happen. And actually, the beauty of this approach is that Proton could disappear off the face of the planet. And if you have actually your recovery, wallet seed phrase, your money is still your money. And this is also another reason why for us being non-custodial was critically important, because that's actually the best outcome, right? Where you don't depend on any third parties, not even us, to maintain control over your assets.
Nice. Now, I'm curious how you deal with, because again, and I'm sorry, maybe I should have done this ahead of time, but I actually kind of wanted to get your impression of it first before I really took a dive. But I haven't used the wallet yet. I've read the article, and then I immediately reached out to you guys, and I was like, oh man, this would be a fantastic episode. So how do you deal with the separate keys from the context of, like, users may touch Bitcoin for the first time through Proton?
Yeah. And when you say separate keys, what are you referring to here?
Just like the username and password for Proton Mail. Then there's like a backup key thing, right? I think I have a backup key or something. And then wallet. Then you have a wallet seed as well. Like, are any of these things derived from each other? Are they attached cryptographically? That sort of thing, I guess, is my question.
They're pretty separate, right? So each Proton account is going to have a recovery phrase. And that's the thing that we ask you to download, keep in a safe place, you know, share with nobody that you don't trust, have it in case you ever forget your password. And that on its own will allow you to get into, you know, your Proton account, including your wallet, in case you ever lose your password and need to recover. So that exists. But separately from that, you can also back up your wallet seed. And your wallet seed, we also recommend you do that as well if you use Proton Wallet. Because if we were to go down completely, we would disappear off the face of the earth. If you have that, you can always take your wallet and regenerate it somewhere else at another wallet provider. So actually, I would say to properly use Proton Wallet, you should keep both, right? The first one ensures you don't lose your Proton account. And the second one ensures you don't lose your money. But depending on what you care about, maybe the wallet seed phrase is all you actually need, right?
Yeah. So the next thing I want to talk about is going forward with this wallet. Have you guys thought about Lightning? And and if you have, what's the difficulty there? Like that seems like a much bigger fish to fry. And I'm curious what your thinking is, or if you're just kind of like leaving it on the table for now. Like what's your thoughts on Lightning?
So I think I can say, you know, without any ambiguity, we like Lightning and we want to do it.
Got you.
So let's just get that out there, right? Then the next one becomes, you know, why haven't you already done it? What's stopping you from doing it, right?
Yeah, come on, Andy. Pick up the pace. What the hell?
And this comes down to, I think, the beginning of the conversation, which is Proton, what we care about at the end of the day, because we don't believe success is possible without it, is user experience. And to have a good user experience with Lightning in a non-custodial way, it simply, in my opinion, isn't possible today, right? It might be possible in a couple of years' time as things develop, but as really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And if you want to, you know, do it in a non-custodial way, then, you know, in the end, users have to open and close their own channels, right? At which point they don't get a lot of the benefits of, you know, the lower transaction costs, right? So
really the LSP model is the only thing that works, but you're trading off privacy when you do that, explicitly.
Yes, exactly, right? So you know, what do you want, right? You want Lightning for privacy? You want Lightning for lower transaction fees? You want Lightning, you know, the problem you want to solve is actually very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I would say that for most users, the benefit of Lightning, at least in the more mainstream context, is faster settlement and, you know, better, you know, transaction fees, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to solve that problem, you today, I would say, have to have a custodial solution. It's kind of the only way to do it in a user-friendly way that gives them those advantages. And that's banking licenses, that's, you know, money transmitting licenses. It's a whole nine yards of stuff, right? And that's something that I think we will work towards, but, you know, kind of incrementally. So I would say Lightning, it's good. It's the future, but the future's not here yet. And we're doing all the research and work to get there, but it's not going to be something that we just turn on immediately because fundamentally the user experience problem is still not yet solved.
Gotcha. Have you looked into the Breeze SDK and stuff and what Blockstream is doing with, they have a like node as a service thing. I cannot remember what the heck the name of it is, but have you heard of the Breeze SDK is maybe my question.
Yeah, we've heard of Breeze SDK. There's another company, I think called Lightspark that's run by
Lightspark,
David Marcus,
who's
working on this, right? Usually, I think they set up with Coinbase recently, mm-hmm. right? Jack at Square is also doing some stuff here as well. They also have their own, you know, library. Actually, we're using their library on some things as well.
Yeah.
So we're in touch with most of the players in the space who mm-hmm. are trying to, you know, innovate and solve this problem. And if there was a good solution, we would have already adopted it, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm also pretty confident that with so many smart people working on this and so much value to be unlocked from doing this properly, that we will probably see advancements in the next 2 or 3 years that make it possible. But you know, as of today, it's just not quite there yet from a mainstream user standpoint.
I'm curious what the biggest hangup is with something like the Breeze SDK or like the Phoenix LSP model. Is it the privacy trade-off that you don't want to compromise on, or is it the fact that fees are a little bit unreliable? You know, because like it's mostly low fees, but then every once in a while you're changing channels and you don't know it, and then you get a high fee. Like, what's that UX? The biggest UX problem with that model, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think in many cases, if you do it in a privacy protecting way, in a non-custodial way, you as an individual don't get the benefits of lower fees, right? Because mm-hmm. you have to open and close your own channels. So this is I think, you know, part of the problem. And then the other, you know, I think element of this is, these things are quite complex, right? You have to run actually quite a bit of compute on your device in order to make it work. It's a struggle to make that even work in a mobile app, actually, in many cases. So the tech is also extremely difficult to get right. So it's actually quite difficult. If you want to give users the seamless experience, like, you know, our goal is to make Bitcoin as easy as PayPal, basically, right? You know, when you use Proton Wallet, the user experience is in many ways indistinguishable from, you know, PayPal if you use our Bitcoin over email feature, right? And with Lightning, we just can't do that yet today. You know, it's not there. And actually, there's people on our team who are a lot smarter and know a lot more about this than I do, right? And they've also looked at it as well. And we're pushing that direction. But I think for the ones who are screaming at us, like, you know, do it. We ask a bit of patience. We're working on it and we want to do it.
Awesome. I'm curious, what's your least favorite thing about dealing with all of this? Like, this seems like a lot to tackle, and you've got a bunch of different services. What's the biggest ugh for you?
So I'll tell you the least favorite thing, and then maybe afterwards the favorite thing, right? So
that works. Bit, right?
I think my answer needs to be a balancing here. So the least favorite thing, and you know, don't take this the wrong way, is actually the community around crypto. because
that's not surprising at all. That's not that is not even slightly surprising. Don't worry about it.
Because it's so toxic, it's so polarized, and it's impossible to have like a sane conversation with people about it, right? So, you know,
everybody is so demanding. Like, and there's like no wiggle room for so much stuff. No, yeah.
No, but there's no room for nuance.
Yes. Yes. That's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it.
Or you're not in my camp, right?
Yeah.
So, so we release a new product and people say, okay, well, you know, why not Monero, right? You know, why not CoinJoin? You know, how come you're not doing NFTs? It's like, what the hell do you want, right? and then there's no right answer, right? No matter whatever you say, you're going to piss somebody off.
Yeah.
And I think that's very unhealthy because for crypto to advance overall, for Bitcoin to advance, we need to have these conversations. We need to discuss the trade-offs and, you know, we need to have nuance and we need to accept different points of views and we need to accept that there's different problems that we're each trying to solve. And it's like the entire conversation is encapsulated in 280, you know, character tweets. And these are longer discussions that you need to have, right? So, you know, someone asked me, oh, you know, why don't you do this? And then I was supposed to give an answer in 280 characters, and then they don't like my answer anyways, right? So kind of what's the point?
And they'll read the first, if you do a longer one, they'll read the first paragraph, and then they'll go ahead and just get their angry response. And that's, you miss it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So they don't even click the, you know, if you pay for the Twitter or the X, you know, premium, they won't even click the, you know, show more, right? So it's like, you can't have a discussion. And I think if you can't discuss it, you can't actually move things forward. And so I think that's the part that bothers me the most. That's the part that is the most annoying about the space, because we're trying to, I think we're trying to do good things here, right? We're trying to make it better. We're trying to actually bring newcomers into the space, trying to make it more interesting, more secure, more easy to use. But you get so much flack for it because you didn't support, you know, random person's favorite coin, right?
Yeah.
And in the end, you can't do everything. So it's I guess later we can discuss why Bitcoin and kind of what is the concept behind that, right? So that's my least favorite part. What is the favorite parts? I think the favorite parts for me of this whole product is really the Bitcoin via email, you know, feature. And I find that to be incredibly cool because typically when you want to do a Bitcoin transaction, it's a, you know, exchange a QR code, exchange a, you know, long hexadecimal random
a big key,
right?
Check the back end.
You know. And then you got to verify it. Okay, you know, did I type in the one that they gave me? Is every single letter correct? Is it right? And then you're talking about like, you want people like my mother to use that. It's like that chance, never going to happen, right? It's never going to work. And that is a friction, a barrier that no one has ever found a way to address. And Bitcoin via email, I think, is really cool because you replace that with an email address. You know, you enter an email and you can send Bitcoin. If I want to send Bitcoin to you, I just enter your email and it's done. And the power of that actually is also, I don't need to previously be in touch with you to even, you know, ask you for an address and verify it, because you have to give me a new address, right? If you give me the same address every single time, it's bad for privacy as well, right? And you know, our Bitcoin via email functionality actually uses a pool of addresses to solve the privacy issue. So I could actually just find your email online somewhere, because everybody's email is out there somewhere, and I could send you a Bitcoin tip without even having told you in advance I want to send you money. And that's done in a privacy protecting way. And I think that's beautiful. That's something that makes it so much easier to use. And then you take that. You combine that with the scale of Proton, right? You know, today we have launched a wallet out in early access. So just a limited subset of, you know, so-called visionary users and the ones that they invite have access to it. So it's, you know, there's not a big pool of users yet. But what we can do, when we want to, when we feel ready to flip the switch, is actually there's 100 million Proton accounts. There's 100 million email addresses. So there's folks that have estimated that the entire crypto space is probably, you know, maybe 500 million people maximum, right? We can bring 100 million people on tomorrow. And that's a 20% increase overnight with a much, you know, easier user experience that I hope can bring the next 500 million, right? And at that point, we've taken something that was really niche, really difficult to use, limited to a small subset of people, really into the mainstream. So that's, I think, the potential of kind of what we're trying to do. And that gets me excited, right? Because if we get to that level of scale, well, I think it's very clear that Bitcoin is not just here to stay, but it's probably going to, you know, truly be able to rival gold, right, as a store of value. So this is exciting. And imagine also the freedom that it gives companies like Proton, right? If I have all of my users, you know, using Bitcoin, being able to pay me on Bitcoin, I no longer have to worry about the centralized bank going down or blacklisting me or banning us because they don't like what we're doing. It solves that problem as well. So I think you know, this for me is a very
gives a way for the customers to pay you. Like it helps you as much as it helps the customers because you now have this entirely new avenue to do business, to trade, whatever, you know.
Yeah, and actually everybody wins. And if you look at Proton's user base, we have, of course, users in North America, in Europe, in kind of high income, stable countries, right? But
God, imagine trying to deal with fiat across all those borders. Holy crap.
Yeah, but if you look recently, we recently had a couple hundred thousand users just join Proton from Venezuela because they needed the VPN to get access to X after the contested election, right? You know, there's millions in Russia who are opposed to the government. There's millions in Iran and places like this where inflation is extremely high. So the ability to give all those millions of people immediate access to, you know, a Bitcoin wallet where they can actually put money that doesn't inflate and isn't printed out of existence, that's also, you know, the social power of that is massive as well. So, of course, there's a massive amount of work to realize that potential, but this is something that gets me excited, and this is why, you know, despite all the things that we're doing, I do believe in this project. It's being done by a skeleton crew. It's not like a massive investment from Proton. It's a very small team doing it. It's a small team that is not working on other products as well, so it doesn't slow down our other efforts. And these guys have worked extremely hard to get it out there. But I think, given the potential that you know we can bring to society, it's worth taking that risk. It's worth making that effort because it's pretty exciting, right?
Yeah. No, for sure. I'm curious from a personal standpoint. So you were working at CERN when you created the first version of Proton Mail. What was the transition like to like a company with 500 people is not a small company, you know? What was that transition like? I'm kind of in a place where Bitcoin Audible has become like, you know, I'm working with five people and I feel like, this is hard. This is unbelievable. Like working with people is difficult as shit. And so like, what was the most difficult part of that transition and like learning how to run something bigger? Cause I'm not really that kind of a person. I'm usually disorganized and I do things with my own flow and I'm not good at setting up a system. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like my system is just in my head. Give me a little bit of a rundown of like what it was like for you to make that transition.
Well, I've talked to people that have, you know, gone a lot further than we have that run much bigger organizations. And I can tell you, you know, what they tell me is it doesn't get any easier. And my experience as well is also it doesn't get any easier at scale. I would say there are kind of two main challenges, right? You know, as a physicist, you're not really taught, how to manage teams and manage people. And that was a skill that had to be picked up, you know, along the way. And what I think also happens is, you know, as organizations grow, as the teams grow, people change, the culture of the company changes, and things evolve, right? It's a bigger company is not going to be the same as a smaller company. It's just different dynamics, right? How do you then preserve the original values and mission of what you're about? Because if you do that, you've kind of lost your way. And I think Google is a pretty good example, right? You know, Google, people don't remember this anymore, but back in the early days, it was, do no evil, right?
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil, right? And today it's like,
good job, you're doing really good.
Yeah. And today it's like, let's be as evil as possible, right? So my fear at Proton is as we scale, what if we lose sight of the original vision, of the original values, and of the original ethos that got us to where we are? And what we've done at Proton is we took a very unconventional step. Right? What we actually did is we transformed our structure into one with a nonprofit foundation. So this was announced over the summer, actually. Proton today is primarily owned by a nonprofit.
Interesting. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. It's been announced, but I guess not everybody knows. And for me, I think the failure of Google was that it was always a company that prioritized profit above everything else. It was a let's return as much money to shareholders as possible at any cost, regardless of the cost. And I think shifting to nonprofit, it changes that dynamic, because if your main shareholder is a nonprofit, your prime directive is no longer to make as much money as possible. Rather, it is to do the things that have the biggest positive impact on society as a whole. Mm-hmm. And this allows you to pursue and make decisions that are actually not good for the business bottom line or even top line, but actually good for the world. And I think this is sort of the balance that we need to bring back into business. And this is maybe the key learning and the key innovation, if you will, of how we have preserved our culture and our values as we grow, as we continue to scale as well.
This is the Swan Bitcoin app, and this is how easy it is to just buy Bitcoin whenever you're feeling like it. And I feel like it right now. And as it shows me right here, I still have $9,388 worth of my $10,000 of Bitcoin buying that has no fees whatsoever. And now I have $10 more worth of Bitcoin. I do this quite often. One of the really great things about Swan is the incredible number of resources they have for learning and understanding anything that you want to know about Bitcoin. And importantly, they're going to teach you why you should not trade. They're not going to encourage you to trade. They are Bitcoin only. If you're looking for an easy and reliable way to get into Bitcoin, if you're looking to put Bitcoin in your IRA, if you're looking to put Bitcoin in your business, if you're looking to do anything around getting on a Bitcoin standard or getting exposed to Bitcoin in your portfolio, check out swanbitcoin.com/guy is my special link, and you will find it very conveniently right in the show notes.
You know, I think I'm shocked the more I learn and the more I like kind of dig deeper into the whole how unbelievably kind of corrupted and how bad the incentives are in the kind of fiat finance world is that how much that is pushed and that you kind of end up in a situation where because you're always paying off debt with a higher movement into higher debt and more financing is that if you don't attack that like right out the gate, you can so easily fall into that where you just don't have, where the VC finance world just kind of pushes you in that direction. Mm-hmm. And you do lose sight of like actually doing the thing that you wanted to do, you know?
Yes.
So that's.
I think this is surprising about Proton is that, we today have no VC investors.
Yeah.
And it's people usually don't manage to get this far without that. And it was definitely more difficult, but I think absolutely important, because it's about kind of at the end, who you're working for, right? Are you working for investors or are you working for the users? And at Proton, because we're, majority nonprofit owned now, I can actually go out there and say, we are in fact working for the community, for the people, our biggest shareholders and nonprofit. And I don't have that conflict of interest. I don't have that inherent conflict. And I think it also preserves culture because it attracts the right people. A company like Google that is incentivized on making more and more money, well, it's going to attract actually people who are drawn to that. Maybe the greedy people that are willing to bend some lines. A company that has doesn't have a moral compass is not going to attract people that have a moral compass. So I think our structure also lets us bring in the people that we know can better preserve these values over time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. It kind of helps to keep the principal agent problem at bay, because you can just build what you want to build that you think is actually valuable. I'm curious, like what's kind of the direction for Proton? I mean, I know y'all, there's just a lot of day-to-day, like keeping things running, but I mean, how big, you said the wallet is a real skeleton crew right now. What's your main focus as a company right now that you think you can provide the most for other people? Like, let's say for me is if I end up going for the whole package with Proton and drop Nord and go Proton VPN and like that sort of stuff, where kind of is the next step with the Proton ecosystem?
Well, if you look at engineering headcount, probably 95 to 98% is almost entirely focused on the existing products. So whether that's a mail product, which is still the biggest product, right? Whether it's the VPN, the drive, the password manager, we are almost entirely focused on what we already have today. Because those products, we actually want them to make them not just private, but in fact, you know, best in class, right? I want to get to the point where even if it wasn't encrypted, you would still want to use it because it actually, you know, was good enough or even better than what Google offers. And if you look at kind of things that we've done this year, you know, we actually launched a document, right? You know, so Proton Documents, it's a collaborative document system built in the Proton Drive. And that's something to take on Google Docs as well. So I think investment on the existing ecosystem, this is where we're going to be focused for, you know, probably the rest of this year, maybe even into next year. At some point in the future, we will want to have, you know, new products as well. The ecosystem to match Google is inevitable and necessary. But we really, I would say, would spend the second half of this year very focused on the core products. And this is, you know, there's a lot of things that users have asked for that we have been late in shipping. You know, it's you're never late because you want to be late, right? You're late because there are complexities that you didn't account for or things are harder than you thought. But yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, we have promised to deliver that we are going to deliver, because at the end of the day, you know, we're not accountable to shareholders, we're really accountable to the community. And what people ask us that they want us to do is what we have to do, because they're the ones that ultimately keep the lights on and pay the bills around here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that sound money, this is one thing that I've dug into quite a bit. And Hayek talks about this in a number of his pieces, is like basically where the capital is coming from. And that's why those fiat incentives can so grossly misalign things, is because if you aren't working from a standpoint that your customers are the ones paying you, well, then doing what's best for your customers is no longer, no matter how much you want it to be, that's not the incentives to keep the thing alive. Like, so if you're getting financing, you're going to do what the bank wants. If you're getting VC funds, you're going to do what the VCs want, because that's how you stay alive. And if you are staying alive because of the customers, you're going to do what the customers, what's going to be best for the customers, which is awesome.
And then the key question here, though, then becomes, you know, is who is the customer? And this is the fundamental issue of Google, right?
Yes.
Because when you use Google, you know, you as a user think you're the customer, but actually you're not. What you are
is the
product being sold to the real customer, which is the advertisers, right?
Yeah.
And this is why I'm pretty convinced in the long run we're going to win, right? I mean, it may seem like a really bold statement, but why? Because in the end, the best product usually wins. And Google is never going to be able to build a best product, because there's always a compromise between what is good for the user and what is good for the customer, which is the advertiser.
Yeah. My search results suck on Google.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's gotten worse and worse, right?
Yeah.
And this will force product compromises that in the end are going to make for a worse product. And I think, you know, the beauty of Proton and what makes, you know, my life a lot easier, you know, most things are harder, right? But this is actually easier, is I can actually do what is best for the customer, because my actual customer is also my user.
Yes. Yes. Got it. We're running to the end of an hour here, and I don't want to take up too much of your time if you don't have it. Again, super thankful that you came on to talk about this. This is really, really cool. I'm curious in where you're going with the wallet. Actually, this brings us back to a previous question, is why Bitcoin only? What got you to kind of like, especially with the frustrations of having to deal with community people and like hard-headedness, what got you on that line of thinking?
Yeah. The analogy I would make is actually the answer to that question is the same exact answer for why Proton started with Proton Mail and with email. Right. Let's go back to 2014. if you were to ask me as a scientist, you know, and give me a clean slate and tell me, build in 2014 the most private and secure communication channel in the world, I would not build you email. Right? Yeah. Email was something that was SMTP was invented in the 1980s without security concerns in mind, right? Because back then, the web as you know it today didn't even exist yet. So why email? It seems kind of a strange choice for, you know, a scientist to pick, because it solves the problem so badly, right? Email is kind of the worst thing for privacy that you can imagine, right?
Yeah.
Well, email, SMTP is terrible at privacy. But it has one important redeeming feature. It is federated and is decentralized. There is no central authority that controls email. Anybody can run their own server, and the protocol, you know, can never really change because you need everybody to agree, right? Which is probably not going to happen because of how decentralized and how federated email is. So those properties actually made email the most successful communication tool ever devised by mankind. Everybody has it. Everybody needs to use it. And despite 30 years of trying to displace it with arguably better technologies, it's still here. Why? Because it has the biggest network. And this exact same analogy can go towards Proton Wallet and Bitcoin, right? If you told me to build the most secure and the most private cryptocurrency today with all that we know today, I probably wouldn't build Bitcoin, right? I would build something that looks quite a bit different, in fact. So why Bitcoin? Well, again, it's the same thing as email, right? It's has the biggest installed base. It has all the properties that make it the most successful digital money. And I really cannot see something else coming along and replacing it because of the network effect. And network effects are extremely important. So if our goal is to actually, give people financial freedom, and also to get people off of centralized platforms and decentralized control of finance, and to also allow freedom of transaction and privacy of transaction, I could try to build an alternative to Bitcoin or support one of the thousands of alternatives, but that's not going to really move the needle because it won't reach enough people. So from a mission standpoint, the best alternative then is to take the largest network that exists, which today is Bitcoin, just like it was, in SMTP and email for communication, and instead solve the problem of how can I make Bitcoin more private? And that's the approach that we've taken. So we didn't pick Bitcoin because it is, the most private out there. It's not. And I think that's not going to offend anybody because it's the truth, right?
I'm offended. I'm pissed. We're getting out of here right now.
Yeah, right. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to take the biggest network and we're going to make it as private, as secure, and as easy to use as possible. And this is completely, I think, in line with Proton's mission from 10 years ago. And this is ultimately the question of, why Bitcoin? And there's some folks that will be very disappointed by that answer, but it's just the way it is today, right? I was a bit disappointed to have to work on SMTP in 2014, but in the end, it was the best way to achieve the mission. And yeah. I think Bitcoin is the same here as well.
Yeah. I think 100 million users with, encrypted email is a pretty good testament to the fact that that was the right choice because, what else in that regard has 100 million users being able to reliably and easily use a tool that does that, So you did this with finding out that Bitcoin was going to be your way around the Indiegogo and PayPal problem. Yeah. And this was back in 2014. I am curious, and especially with your, nonprofit customers are your customers, are the users, like all that thinking and the avoiding the VC trap, as I think of it. Do you still have Bitcoin from 2014? B, does ProtonMail put Bitcoin on its balance sheet? And C, how do you think Bitcoin played a role in the ability to take the path that you guys took?
Okay. It's a good question. And I have to be careful how I answer, because you know, in this space, you can always say too much, right? But I'll tell you, our original Bitcoin from the crowdfunding, we still have them. And,
yes. Yes. Well done.
Yeah. Proton doesn't really sell the Bitcoin that we receive. And we've been, accepting it for, you know, quite some time. So it does make up a portion of our treasury. And we do it this way because we think it's a very important form of diversification. It's a form of risk mitigation. And I can give you actually a very concrete example of this, right? We're based in Switzerland, and I'm actually here in Geneva, Switzerland. And last year, there was an incident where one of the largest Swiss banks, Credit Suisse, went down, right? This was actually not so long after, you know, Silicon Valley Bank went down. And there was sort of a discussion of, okay, well, you know, is Credit Suisse going to be bailed out or not get bailed out? And actually, we had a lot of our money sitting in Credit Suisse. So a lot of people in Switzerland had a very uncomfortable weekend, pondering that question. But because we had our Bitcoin, treasury and our Bitcoin reserve, we knew that we could, survive that blow, even if it came. And I think that shows you kind of the power of cryptocurrencies and the power of Bitcoin and why it's important to diversify. We are still holding it. Now, do we use some of our, Bitcoin to avoid going down the VC path? Well, the answer to that actually is no, right? Because then we would have to sell them, right?
Yes.
So actually, we were fortunate enough, I think, to have a very large and supportive community of users that have been, paying us since the very beginning for the services that we provide. And this allowed us to prudently, manage our funds and go the distance, without having VC money and without having to, sell very many Bitcoins, let's say.
Nice.
Yeah. So in some sense, if the question is, is Proton a holder? I would say, yeah, more or less, right?
Yeah. Now that classifies. That totally classifies. Are you going to be at a Lugano Plan B at towards the end of October? You guys do the conference circuit in your area at all? Because I'll actually be down there.
Well, if you're down there, you're going to probably fly through Zurich or Geneva, right? Probably most likely Zurich. So you should hit us up, say hi, and we can meet in person. Happy to do it. But to be honest, we're not so often on the conference circuit.
Gotcha.
And the reason is, we're more builders than talkers. We keep our heads down. We do our own things, and we hope the work will speak for itself. We're every once in a while on stage somewhere, but more or less, we have a long list of things that the community wants us to do. We're going to focus on doing that, and hopefully, that will speak louder than any talk at a conference.
Hell yeah, man! All right. Well, if I come to the area, I might actually take you up on that. I might hit you up and see if we can hang out in person. I'd love to meet you, shake your hand. And just want to say thank you for everything you've done with Proton. Like I said, I've been a pretty long time user. I said a couple of years, but I think it's probably 5 years. Like I've been shilling everybody the Proton mail for quite some time. And I'm really stoked about this direction. I can't believe how little I knew about the story and everything that led to this. So kudos to everything. And thank you again for your time, man.
Yeah, of course. It was really a pleasure to be on the show. And I think for any of the listeners out there, we're here to work for you, right? So if you see something that you want us to build, could be you or anybody else out there, let us know. Get on X, get on Reddit, tell us what you want. And if we can make it happen, we will do it. So
awesome.
Yeah, thanks again. And yeah, looking forward to being part of this adventure, and I'm sure we'll speak some more in the future.
Hell yeah, man. Thanks, dude. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. That was fascinating, and I learned a lot about Proton Mail that I didn't know, and I'm really stoked to see them, like, the
the promise of being able to just easily and non-custodially send Bitcoin from your email address to somebody else's email address, and being able, like, as he said, like, having a tool, a way to use Bitcoin, and a way to use a communication system that is private, that is truly end-to-end encrypted, in which you can send Bitcoin peer-to-peer with just a email address and what you already have as far as contact info, that you don't have to create this new thing that feels unfamiliar, and it's just simple and it just works. And the way you can do that with just a far better and far simpler user experience, their focus on that, I feel like, is really, really promising. And it is really cool to see them try to tackle that mission and trying to make this tool, make this available and useful for as many people as possible and with the best user experience possible. So this is something I will 100% be keeping a very, very close eye on. And I will probably be using Proton Mail a lot more after this. Hopefully I'll have the link to the announcement article so that you can put in your email for access to the beta. The closed group right now, if you want to try to get early access. And I will obviously be sharing out, if you want to follow me on Noster or Twitter or YouTube, subscribe to the show and everything. I will be talking about it as soon as it is available, so you won't miss it. There are links and details in the show notes, not only to our sponsors, but also to Andy Yin, to Proton Mail, so that you can check out their service and their tools if you do not know it yet. And yeah, I think that should wrap us up. With that, thank you guys so much. Another shout out to Andy for coming on the show. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys.